This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Are you going to the Australian Open for the tennis or for the tunes? Because the line between sporting events and music festivals, they're starting to blur. From the Grand Prix to the AFL Grand Final to the Australian Open. Maybe sport is a new way to actually support Australian musicians. So can sport and music live side by side and actually work together? Forever we have tried to compare sport and music. It's been a sport versus music city. But should it be a sport and music city? Do they actually belong together? Do you go to major sporting events for the sport or for the entertainment? And how do you feel about the two being side by side? 1300 222 774. And also coming up this half hour, the rise of the uninsured home in bushfire-prone areas. How does that impact not just the individual homeowner, but how can it impact the entire community?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So the AO kicked off yesterday, and you would have noticed people with lanyards. You would have seen all of the sponsored cars. There were plenty of people out and around the stadium. Huge crowds. But are they all going for the tennis? There is more and more live music at sporting events like the Australian Open. And forever in Victoria, we have compared music against sport and vice versa. But now the two worlds are colliding. So is it a win for everyone? Dr. Sam Whiting, Vice Chancellor, Senior Research Fellow of Media and Communications at RMIT. Sam, when you go to the AO, are you going for the tennis or the tunes?
A bit of both, but mainly the tunes. I'm really quite excited about the music programming this year at the Australian Open, particularly because there's a massive emphasis on Australian talent. We've got the Veronicas, Cassian, The Presets, Kid Laroi, Spacey Jane, all headlining different nights of the AO Live program. And tickets to those shows are accompanied by a ground pass to the tennis. So there's that great integration of, you know, watch a bit of tennis, see a great band, or watch, you know, bit of, if you're going for the tennis, you get a little side dish of excellent Australian talent as well.
So for local musicians, we know, and you and I have spoken at length as we have across this station, about the future of music festivals, their viability. They've shut down at a drop of a hat, insurance is through the roof. Is this where, like, are sporting events picking up the slack, or are they stealing the concept?
Maybe a bit of both, but I would argue that you know, there are performance opportunities at big major events that are drying up for Australian artists. And I think it's really important that, you know, the organisations and the events that do have the capacity to put on and give a platform to local talent use that opportunity. And I think if we look at the Australian Open compared to the NRL Grand Final, the AFL Grand Final, which are both, you know, some of the biggest sporting events in our country, those events chose to host North American artists for those, like, massive broadcast numbers. And I think it's like, I've got to take my hat off to the Australian Open for consistently emphasizing Australian talent.
This is from Susan in Mount Wallace. It says, great topic. Music festivals are possibly dying because they do not include sport. I'd really like to see music promoters supporting sport more and more, scheduling at the AFL match, maybe some horse racing alongside those acts as well. However, as a lifelong tennis fan, I have no interest in buying tickets to the Australian Open for non-tennis events and gimmicks. I'm much happier to watch the actual tennis on the TV. So I wonder how diehard tennis fans feel about music and that festival atmosphere coming into the Australian Open. We've got record numbers and crowds. We have always in this city, we've loved to pit music against sport. You know, you're either one or the other. You can't love going to the footy and love going to a gig, or who produces more economic impacts for our state, you know, music versus sport. What happens when we say, oh, no, we love them both and they can both hang out in the same venues? Is our city ready for that?
I think Melbourne is a city that embraces sport and music equally. And you see, you know, events like Community Cup. I'm a veteran of the Renegade Pub Football League, which, you know, where each live music venue across the inner north hosts a footy team. I think these are both sport and music bring people together, and there's no reason why we can't have both, and we can't have both in the same place at the same time. You know, obviously with a little logistics to keep that working. I think the Australian Open have done a good job of having the music programming as a separate but kind of integrated event. You know, you can go and just see the Veronicas without necessarily seeing any tennis, but you do get a ground pass with that Veronicas ticket. So you can go for a wander, see a few side matches, you know, a few lesser names, not maybe the big ticket finals, but, you know, you can go and explore the grounds. And I think that's what Australian Open's trying to do.
You're with Dr. Sam Whiting, Vice Chancellor, Senior Research Fellow for Media and Communications at RMIT. Sport and music hand in hand, is it a good idea? Elaine in Croydon South says, I go for the sport alone. Having music there drives me nuts. If I wanted to hear music, I'd go to a music concert. Bill's in Wodonga. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Rich. How you going?
Good, mate. What do you think?
I actually like the idea. I've never ever been to the tennis. I've always going to say I'll go this year, and I never do. But I also like to go for the atmosphere around the place. So even though it's a sporting event, classic one is cricket. I love watching the crowd, the way they react, and that's what I'd love with the tennis too. Just watching the crowd, but also enjoying a little bit of the music.
It certainly created a huge atmosphere. I mean, yesterday there was barely any tennis. I think we're in qualifiers. Mm. The vibe, I went for a walk around the tan after work. There were people everywhere. Mm. You can hear all different accents as well. You can tell people are visiting. It certainly does generate energy. But at the same time, Bill, you know, people are kind of a bit annoyed about crowd numbers and saying, oh, it's, you know, it's over. There's too many people here. I wonder whether a lot of that is because people aren't going just for the tennis anymore.
Well, when you look at it, all right, how many people do they fit in Rod Laver Arena? Did anyone ever carry on that there was too many people sitting in there?
Mm.
But now there's actually room in there, you will actually find, because some people won't go there for the whole day. They'll actually get up and walk outside. And it's good to be able to just stretch your legs, even if you go out for half an hour.
Yeah.
Enjoy a bit of music, then go back in. At least you're not cramped and sitting in the one spot.
I like the idea, too, of being able to go maybe with friends or with family members. You'd be like, okay, I'm going to go see a band. You can go watch some tennis, and really broadening it out. This message that says, I love both music and sport. I don't want them together. I hate that people separate these two things, as I've never enjoyed the two of them side by side. The Australian Open, are they taking the acts away from the festivals or the venues that need them? Because they've got a lot of money, right? The Grand Prix, the Australian Open, the AFL, these are cash cows, baby. Mm. And we've got festivals that are struggling. We've got music venues that are struggling that don't have the money. Are they stepping on ground they shouldn't?
Yeah, maybe. But I guess I wouldn't pit them against each other. I'd say sport is incredibly well-funded in this country, and maybe we should think about funding the arts as well as we fund sport.
Okay, so flipping it. All right, so so use some of your cash to support the arts.
Well, I think it's great that some of these sporting events do use that capacity, but also most sporting events receive massive government subsidies or grants. I think we need to think more deeply about what our priorities are and whether there's an opportunity to raise the funding of arts and music to the same level of sports.
Let's have a chat to Chris, who's in Frankston. Hi, Chris.
Hi. We're going to the Open on the second Saturday. And I'm a big sports fan, but I'm more than happy for a bit of music, especially Australian artists, and it'll add to the atmosphere, as the other caller said.
It's a win-win for you, Chris?
Yeah, it is, yeah. We like the atmosphere because we've been to two big bass matches in the city, and it's all about the atmosphere as much as the cricket.
I can remember years ago there was a program that was put on at the AFL. I think it was from Music Victoria, where they would put on, before the footy, Australian artists. I remember seeing Paris Wells and a few people like that. And it was wonderful. And also, too, it's hard to get out and see gigs sometimes. Mm. And to be able to see young and emerging local artists at the footy and having programs like that, I found that really good. Danny's in Daylesford. Hi, Danny.
Oh, hiya. Now, here's the thing. It's the cost of going to these events that's one of the issues with most people today, I think, in today's economic environment. So if you've got to consider add-on inclusion, it's like going to a takeaway and they say, do you want fries with that or do you want to upsize, you know? I don't want to if it costs more. If you're going to give me a free exercise drink or a free exercise fries, throw it in. Yeah, I'm happy to accept that, but if I have to pay extra for a band that's going to be in there or something else that's going to be there, and I'll watch it for the sake of trying to get some value for money, you know, it's sort of detracting from what I'm really there for.
Do we know whether or not it's pushing? I mean, the AO, I know Craig Tiley was on with Limo on Breakfast this morning talking about the fact that tickets start as low as $20 and then go up higher depending on how close you get to finals. But is Danny right in that the more that's there, the more that it potentially costs and you're paying for a band when you actually want to go and see tennis?
So the tickets for the live music events are a separate ticket that includes a ground pass. But if you're buying tickets to a semi-final or a final, you're not also including in that is going to see the Veronicas or the Presets or Lucky Leroy. Because I think the event understands that they are different audiences. You know, there is some overlap, but they are different audiences and people don't necessarily want those hidden add-ons. But I think to the previous callers, the atmosphere, I mean, we've heard that spoken about a few times. It is kind of like a festival now. And that really, like, that makes going to the event much more of a pleasure. It's also a family event. And I think exposing young people, families, people that might not be able to go out to, you know, a dive bar or a big stadium concert or you know, a music festival in some far-flung field.
I don't want to go to a music festival. I don't want to sleep in a tent. I don't want to go to the toilet in the portaloo.
Well, this is the great thing about, I think it becomes a family event. You know, it's all fun for young and old and it's accessible.
Dr. Sam Whiting, speaking of atmosphere, I had a very proud moment with my daughter over the holidays. It was one of those stinking hot days and we were in a shopping centre trying to escape the heat. And like many people, she is addicted to Stranger Things. Now, the soundtrack for Stranger Things is like the best of the best of the 80s. And as a result, she started to get into vinyl. And she said to me, Mum, can we go shopping for vinyl?
Fantastic.
I'm like, oh, heart explodes. Yeah. Yes, we can. However, we were in a major shopping centre. So there was one particular large music-ish store. You can also buy televisions and all sorts of, you know, electronic equipment there, but they have a vinyl section. And we went in there and even just the art of flicking through vinyl, you know, my fingers haven't flicked through vinyl like that in a very long time. Two things became very apparent to me. The first thing is, when the hell did a record become close to $100? The second thing is, I had to turn to her and say, sweetie, this is not how you buy vinyl. The atmosphere, the vibe, someone's buying a ridiculously large TV behind us. There is no music nerd here to help us. The atmosphere for buying vinyl felt dirty. It felt wrong. So to my first question, $100 for a piece of vinyl.
Yeah, inflation's hit a lot of things, but it's hit vinyl in particular. Cost of shipping, you know, there's a lot of global conflicts going on and that impacts the cost of shipping. But I think with vinyl in particular, what happened was all of the manufacturers shut down when CDs became the main way we listen to music and then streaming. So there was a point in time where there was only one vinyl factory operating in the world. It was in the Czech Republic. My old indie band got some vinyl pressed there. But what's happened is we really have, it's really expensive to press and manufacture and ship vinyl. The other thing I would say is that artists don't have many revenue streams these days. Mm. Streaming has really killed the ability for artists to make money on their recordings. Live touring is a revenue stream, but you know, there's only so many dates in a year you can tour around the world. So vinyl has become a big cash cow for artists. Well, you know, artists that are struggling, they need those additional revenue streams, but Taylor Swift and Sabrina Carpenter, you know, they're able to do like multiple pressings of the same release with different hidden tracks.
Well, that was the thing. So speaking of Sabrina Carpenter, her vinyl was there. That was, you know, somewhere between $80 and $100. I was like, whoa. And then I kept flicking through and there was like the best of Olivia Newton-John, bless, love Livy. Mm. But even that, I was surprised that there was a brand new record of the best of Olivia Newton-John on vinyl. But even that was about $70.
Yeah, so catalog is a really big cash cow for major labels. And when you think about it, we have been buying Olivia Newton-John records in different formats for decades. So when they were first pressed to vinyl, we bought them. When they were pressed to cassettes and CDs, we bought them again. We started listening, and then we listened to her on streaming.
Maybe she's a bad example because she's the best. But
she is fantastic. But I guess my point is that it's the major labels benefit really a lot from you continuing to rebuy the same catalog in different formats over and over again.
So vinyl is back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But are we able to press it and to make it? And then a little part of me felt, as I said, felt dirty shopping for vinyl in a major shopping center, in a major department store type place. I thought, wow, I wonder, where are the record stores near us?
Well, I've got good news for you because Melbourne has some of the most record stores per capita in any city in the world. We have hundreds of record stores around this city, and we have some of the highest vinyl consumption, which means we have a lot of people who know a lot about records, new releases and old, that you know you can have a chat to behind the counter. There's a great underground metal record store on Sydney Road near me. Black Sound Records, which I go into every now and again. And some of the releases there are so obscure, I wouldn't know where to start.
Well, this is the thing, and it's the vibe of the place. You know, absolutely. To quote Dennis DeNuto, this where and how you buy not just music but vinyl in particular, to take it back to the Australian Open, you need the atmosphere. You need the tunes playing. You need some cool cats behind the counter that are going to give you a little bit of information or introduce you to a new band. And then the other thing was, because we're avid op shoppers, I'm like, okay, we're just going to hit the records in the op shops and flick through as well. But atmosphere and knowledge, do we have that still?
Oh, yeah. We have some very niche bespoke record stores. Any genre you're into, there is a record store dedicated to that genre in Melbourne. So if you're getting into vinyl or you've been a long-time collector, you are kind of spoiled for choice in Melbourne, really.
Is there a 1980s record store somewhere?
if there's I'm not, sure.
Should we open
I'm sure.
One?
I think there's multiple on Sydney Road.
Of course there is. Always good to speak with you, Sam. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Sam Whiting, Vice Chancellor, Senior Research Fellow of Media and Communications at RMIT. Lots of people saying, and I agree, saying, yes, major retailers like that, they are so expensive. You've got to choose the smaller retailers. That's why we walked out. I could not agree more. Too expensive and the vibe was just not right. And do you like your sport and music to combine? Keep those calls coming through. We'll get back to them a little later.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Keep your calls on how you like to buy your vinyl coming through. We'll get back to them a little later. Well, you may have heard the Premier yesterday announce assistance payments for just over $52,000 for those to help those who are uninsured, for the homes who have been lost or impacted or affected by the fires, and if you had no insurance. But the idea of not being insured, not being able to afford home insurance or being even that title of so-called self-insurance, is it on the rise, in particular in bushfire-prone areas, because people simply cannot afford their insurance? And what does it mean not just to the homeowner, but what does it mean to the entire community? Nikki Hutley is an independent economist and counsellor with the Climate Council. Nikki, I mean, are we going to just hear and see the term self-insured or no insurance? Is this just happening more and more? Is this a growing concern for people like yourself?
Look, it is absolutely a growing concern, and we have already seen it, particularly when you think about the devastating events that we have had over the last 5 years, both fire and flood. And those combined with increasing numbers of houses, the increasing expense of houses and the cost of rebuilding have meant that premiums have just been rising much more rapidly even than the cost of living, which is overall causing people, has caused people problems in recent years. So it is something we're worried about. Obviously, climate change is making us more vulnerable and at greater risk, and insurance is all about risk pricing. So if the risk goes up, then we know that the price is going to go up too. And the question is, what are the things that we can reasonably do about it as homeowners or renters, because they're more of those around, as governments, of course, and as insurers and the private sector more broadly.
So what can we do? I mean, let's look at the role of government here. I mean, is it about ensuring that there's healthy competition and not just one or two insurers who can do and ask and act however they choose?
Yeah, so we've had a number of inquiries in recent years, government inquiries into insurance, looking as to what is the underlying cause. And nowhere has anyone found that there is insufficient competition in the insurance sector. Yes, there are, a smaller number of large insurers that basically cover all of the smaller companies, but there is still a relatively healthy level of competition going on in that industry. What we need to look at more closely is actual risk and how we price it. So the things we need to do are, one is to do whatever we can to help with climate change, which is making these events worse. And obviously there's so much that we can do about that, and we certainly can't change things overnight, but we definitely need to be looking at reducing emissions. But more immediately, even if the world can do a lot better job on that front, we have already baked in 1.5 degrees. And whilst that might not sound that much of increased global warming, that actually is going to increase risk. So we need to deal with adaptation. That means we need to make our homes more fireproof, floodproof, resilient to cyclones. Now, every state government and the federal government has got resilience programs. We have a national risk assessment. We have a national adaptation plan, but it is very much at this stage very tentative steps. We need to be doing a lot more. If you look at certainly in New South Wales, Victoria, the reconstruction authorities have been doing a lot of work in this space to help people to make their homes and properties as resilient as they can be, and then to make their communities as resilient as they can be. So that's things like fire breaks, making sure that properties around properties are cleared, making sure that they are at safe heights for floodwaters. So both flood and fire, there are things we need to do. And then, of course, there will be areas that are such high risk that it's not actually safe for people to be living there. Now, that is probably more related to flood, but
the question comes in of why we built there in the first place, and the risk that comes to community along with that. And it's hard to think about this at the moment because people are still living through the fires. Physically, they're still burning. People have just started to go into recovery phase. However, if people do choose to rebuild, and you spoke about looking at things like fireproofing and how we build, what's being done to ensure that if people do rebuild, that there is the assistance, there is the capability, the technology, even affordability to be able to rebuild in a way that is safer than what we previously have done? Is that possible?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily easy, but it's certainly possible. And, for somebody who's had a home that wasn't previously at the highest fire rating standard or flood for that matter, but let's just take fire, there are simple tools. There's a bushfire rating app that you can get that's through the Insurance Council, and the industry more broadly has put out. So you can actually go through and look at your home and the ratings that are there. It can tell you what you can do to an existing property to make it increase the rating and make it, you know, one is the lowest. You want to be at five. But for new builds, there are very strict standards for bushfire resilience ratings, and those need to be adhered to. And councils need to make sure when properties are or developments are approved that they're out there checking that those standards are in fact adhered to.
Nikki Hutley is with the independent economist and also a councillor with the Climate Council. Let's have a chat to John, who's in Benalla. Hi, John. What did you want to say?
Look, I'm a town planner. I'm adjacent to where the fires have been, and many homes could have been saved except for the over-regulation of what you can and can't do with the land. And at the moment, there's a 10-30 rule, which allows you to clear trees 10 metres from your house. But if you've got a 10-metre candle bark, a highly incendiary native, if it's 20 metres from your house, it'll destroy your house. So it's going to make it's impossible for people to protect their own dwelling. So there needs to be changes in the Victorian planning scheme to stop the over-regulation, to look at the vegetation protection overlays and those sorts of things so people can protect their home. Otherwise, they will be uninsurable.
Yeah, and John, that's a debate I know I've had on this radio station for decades now. Nikki, has the red tape got tighter or looser over the years for homeowners?
Look, there's no doubt in the construction industry there are a lot of standards that have to be adhered to. They are aiming to make people safe, to make homes resilient, to make them lower emissions. But I think that the argument around tree type is really interesting one. And, you know, often when we're trying to deal with one problem, you know, we raise some sort of unintended consequence. And this might be that a particular species of protected tree is particularly incendiary. And as John said, having it any distance, you know, within 30 metres of your home might not be safe. The question then is, what are we prioritising? Are we prioritising where we build, so we're going to clear these precious native forests, or are we prioritising the safety and we'll say, well, we'll take some reduction in those incendiary trees closer to the home and allow, you know, a wider radius of clearing and have, you know, new tree plantings elsewhere further away to try and offset some of the impact. But, you know, we've got to look at all these things, because obviously every time we clear native vegetation, whether it's forests or bushland, you know, we're impacting all of wildlife, and they're all connected, and they're all connected to our own health. Biodiversity is, the economy runs on biodiversity. So we need to be very careful with how we're balancing those different risks.
It's interesting. There's a text here that says, "Hi, Rochelle. In the Canberra bushfires back in 2003, my parents' place had the fire front come right up to them. It was stopped by liquid amber trees. The neighbours' homes all burnt down. I think we can plant trees that don't burn around towns and homes that can stop the fire front." Is that possible, Nikki? I know that's a bit of a question without notice for you, but can trees stop fire?
Look, you'd have to talk to both a fire expert and a tree expert to. I honestly don't know which trees. I mean, clearly some susceptible trees burn more than others. You know, we want to make sure that the trees that we're planting are predominantly native trees as well. And again, it comes back to that point around what is the environmental impact of doing more clearing, or planting trees that might not be natives but have, you know, greater fire retardant properties. So we just need to, and I'm not an expert in that, so
yeah,
I won't.
Sure. No, that's fine. There's just so many different texts coming in on this. And I know in the past, Nikki, I've spoken on this program about other areas in snow areas, for example, a lot of ski resorts having to shut down because they simply couldn't afford the insurance. And a handful of people were talking about a bit of a bubble of community insurance where, almost like that self-insured but en masse, so people coming together and creating almost a subset, like creating their own cooperative of insurance. Is that sounds risky to me, but is that something that you're hearing? Are people considering options like this?
Look, people are considering all sorts of options, and obviously we've seen the insurance industry has been under incredible stress. I think in Australia it does remarkably well compared to, say, you know, what the situation we saw in California, where regulation really was problematic. But nevertheless, when risk is rising, obviously the cost is going to rise. But if you have a pool of people who are in the same high-risk area getting together, the cost of insurance is going to increase, not decrease, because by spreading it across broader areas where you've got low risk and high risk, everybody, you know, pays, some people will pay a bit more than they might other, but generally speaking, we're fairly happy to do that. Of course, now we're starting to see some areas targeted, and we've certainly seen that with flood insurance in the Northern Rivers, where people are saying, you know, $35,000-$40,000 is the quote they've got. But overall, concentrating the risk is mathematically going to make you pay more, not less.
Fascinating. I think we're going to have a longer chat another time, Nikki, because lots of people with lots of thoughts on this. This is just one of them saying, I'm a bit worried about the announcement from the Premier yesterday. What signal does this send to people to not bother about insuring your home? I understand the amount isn't enough to cover the cost of a home, but it does nothing to reward people who have made sure that their properties are insured. And it does create a lot of tension. But Nikki, thanks for your time and your insights. We might have a longer chat maybe in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Rochelle. Cheers.
See ya. Nikki Hutley, independent economist, and she's also a councillor with the Climate Council. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, we're going to have a chat to the deputy editor of ABC Sport. They have conducted a landmark study alongside with Deakin University, looking at 152 female athletes across 40 sports. Has it got any better? Has it got any better from pay to conditions to the research that's being done on women's bodies? How far have we progressed?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The ABC conducted its own survey. This is an incredible landmark survey. It was done in partnership with Deakin University, and it looked at 152 female athletes across 40 different sports. And the research was done to look at everything from how much women earn, racism, sexism, body issues, you name it. We like to think we're making inroads and that we're getting better. But are we? Amanda Shalala is the deputy editor of ABC Sport. Amanda, I'm kind of holding my breath. Like I've read through the report and even reading it, you sort of read it with one eye open, one eye closed, hoping that we are getting better and that we are making inroads. First things first, why did you want to conduct this research on professional female athletes?
Hi, Rochelle. Well, a lot of research has been done in this area, but it's quite fragmented. So often you'll have academic research which looks at one particular area. It may look at gendered violence. It may look at social media trolling. It may look at pay. But it's very rare to have it all come under the one umbrella. And it is usually done very much with that academic lens put on it. And so it gets published in journal articles, but the wider public doesn't really know much about it. We're very passionate about elevating women's sports stories and women in sport generally. So we thought we need a broad state of play of how things are looking for athletes in an Australian context, and not just to put the raw numbers out there, but to marry it up with the very personal stories so people can connect to it and relate to it, and hopefully so we can drive positive change in the women's sport landscape.
How are we doing? If you had to rate the Australian context of how women are faring is as elite sports people out of 10, Amanda, what would you give us?
I think it varies by the sport, I'd say, but by and large, not great though, is what our survey showed. So let's say middling, 5 out of 10. Some having poorer experiences and some having better, to play it a bit safe. But
room for improvement, as your teacher would say.
Well, definitely.
Let's start with pay, because that's the first thing that we're always shocked at, just what female athletes get paid versus men. How are we faring there?
This was really stark, these results. So of the survey respondents, we found that 39% of them said they earned nothing annually from sport. So that means they're scraping together money through different means just to try and get by with their living expenses plus pursuing their sport as well.
39%.
Yes.
Wow.
And then 36% earning between $5,000 to $20,000 annually. So the vast majority are earning barely anything from sport, less than minimum wage. And to put it into context, we're not speaking necessarily just about athletes who are recreational in tiny sports. Our results included Paralympians, Olympians, athletes from the major professional codes in Australia, as well as those from smaller sports. So I don't think it's been skewed by having too many from small non-professional sports. I think it's just a reality that women are still very far behind when it comes to pay.
And yet, you know, if you look at the Winter Olympics coming up or any major global sporting focus, we love to celebrate our athletes. And a lot of the time, you know, they're paying for their own airfares to get there, or they're having to buy their own uniforms, or they're having to crowdfund, or they're having to rely on family and friends to look after children if there's no even childcare offered. So we love to celebrate the wins, but as fans, as sports fans, there has to be a sense of responsibility that comes back onto us, I would think, to create change, help create change.
I think so. If you're just going to leave it to the hierarchy, we've gotten to this point. There definitely has been progress made. I don't want to be too doom and gloom. Yes, we have come a long way, but this was starting, you know, 150 years behind men's sport. And so if we're going to just wait for things to continue to grow organically, who knows how long it could take? It does require drastic change in some situations. And so I think a lot of these athletes say when it comes to pay, they're not necessarily saying, okay, pay us exactly the same as the men right now, because in some of the major men's codes, perhaps that's too overblown in terms of how much they're getting paid. It's just getting to a fairer space where they can be valued for the work that they put in, and remembering the value that athletes and sport does bring to Australian society as well. Yes, it's just a game to many people, but they're actually very important role models. They can teach us a lot about who we want to be. It can open up conversations to bigger issues like the gender pay gap, like racism, like gendered violence. We can have these discussions through sport. So that's why it is a very important industry to support adequately, and particularly women, to show that not only do we value women and their place in sport, but also more broadly in society as well.
You're listening to Amanda Shalala, the Deputy Editor of ABC Sport. We're talking about the results of the ABC's Elite Athletes in Australian Women's Sport Survey. It was done in partnership with Deakin University. It took 152 athletes across 40 sports with the lens firmly on women. There's lots of different areas we could cover, but I wanted to talk to you about how much you looked at research into women's bodies. Our bodies are different to men, and we bleed, we have boobs, we've got all different things, we have babies. And over the years, a lot of the research that's come into physicality was still through the lens of male bodies and not women's bodies at all. Hormones, it was completely ignored. Are we getting better at research and how our bodies physically work?
We know across the board, when you're looking at academic or medical research, I think the numbers are about between 10 to pushing maybe up to 20% now of all studies that are actually focusing on women or including a majority of female participants in that sports, science, medicine space, which is quite astonishing to think that some of the things we think about, it's just being applied to a default male body, which when 50% of the population is not male.
Yeah.
So in terms of our survey and what we found in this space, 75% of athletes told us they experience menstrual irregularities. Nearly half experience eating disorders or disordered eating, which is way more than the general Australian population. Around 70% said they don't think there are enough female coaches in their sport, which is then harming them because there are not enough people in leadership positions who understand women's health and women's bodies to adequately support them. So there's a lot of things in this area where there are still gaps. A lot of people said they had delayed pregnancy because of sport and that there aren't sufficient maternity protections in place for them. So a lot of these issues, I think, again, are relevant to a broader population. It's interesting to hear the experiences of elite athletes, but I think so many people could relate to this, of losing your period and not understanding why and not realizing how that could impact your bone density, your fertility, how serious that could be when you're striving to just look thinner and thinner, like the really damaging consequences to your physical health and your mental health as well if you're doing that, and that you're not going to be able to perform at your best.
Are you hoping then, because I mean, that was 70% that you're talking about, they're huge kind of numbers, especially when it comes to body image, whether that be trolling, some form of disordered eating. Does that, do you hope then that this survey and these results will then help shape the sort of people we see that are needed on teams and the sort of coaches that we need and the sort of professionals that are needed in the elite sporting family? You know, we've seen mental health come into focus both for men and women, and we have team psychologists and we have all sorts of things. Does this pave the way for other types of professionals that could work themselves into these sporting families?
Yes, and a lot of sports have been starting to do this. Let's say pelvic health is a massive area for men and women, but often women are more so affected in this space. And there's a misconception that, oh, you only have pelvic health issues after you have children. But in fact, anyone can experience it. And a lot of girls, say, in sports like gymnastics or trampolining, very aerobic sports, they can experience urinary incontinence and they don't know what to do about it. They're embarrassed, they're shy. But now some sports are bringing in women's pelvic health physiotherapists to teach them about it and to help them through that. So I think you need those very specialized subsets to be able to help in some of these spaces. And that's why we've worked with Deakin University on this study. It originated from us, but we wanted to bring them on board to use their expertise to be able to liaise with the sporting clubs and organizations to dive a bit deeper into the results with them. So it's not just about the storytelling piece for us. It's about let's go to the sports and get some change
and create
happening.
Some change. Yeah, well, congratulations. It's incredible. We've only touched on the surface of it. And again, I've said this so many times today, but I'm not lying. Amanda, I think we need to have a longer chat about it. So thank you. And people can jump onto the ABC's website. If you just put in Elite Athletes Australian Women's Sports Survey, that will come up. It's on Instagram. It's on all the socials and it's on the ABC's website as well. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you so much, Rochelle.
See ya. Amanda Shalala, Deputy Editor for ABC Sport. So as I said, if you want some more information about this survey, it's really in-depth, done alongside with Deakin University, 152 athletes, 40 sports with a focus on women and how far we have or haven't come when it comes to women's health. You can go and search for the Elite Athletes of Australian Women's Sports Survey. 10 minutes away from midday, as I said, a little later, Bridget Duclos from 12:30 will be live from Castle Mayne Relief Centre. And the focus there will be looking at what the next stages are, how community, how the wider public can support each other. And you may have heard that there's been some support and some funding announced again yesterday from the Premier around an existing program that's called Look Over the Farm Gate program. So this is a program that supports farming communities who are experiencing stress. They're going to provide financial grants, and Alison Kennedy is the director of the National Centre for Farmer Health. Alison, this money, I think it's in bundles of around $5,000. It's the body that oversees your group, which is the look over the farm gate. How can this money be accessed and utilised to help farmers and their mental health during this really tough time?
Yeah, thanks, Rochelle. So the National Centre for Farmer Health are administering the Look Over the Farm Gate community grants. And you're right, the grants are available between around $1,500 and $5,000 per event. And they're really focused on supporting mental wellbeing in farming communities. And that can be from a social connection perspective. It can also be about building capacity around mental health education. Can be improving people's physical health and wellbeing, which we also know contributes to mental wellbeing. So it's quite a broad community grant program.
What I like about the sound of this is that it's offering money to create events, you know, relatively small community-based events, because that's what generates social connection. And every community will be different. Every community will know their community more than anyone from the outside. So whether it be, I don't know, off the top of my head, a book club or some kind of small get-together or a music event or whatever it may be to create social connection. Am I thinking about this right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the grant program has actually been running for sort of the last 6 months of 2025 as well in response to drought. And we've seen, you know, over 130 successful events already being held across Victoria with these small grants. And yes, some of what you're exactly what you're saying, some of the really good examples. I guess what we would encourage people when they're thinking about, planning an event is to think about exactly what sort of activity would be most beneficial for their community. Mm. You know, who's the target audience? Is it going to be farming families? Is it farming women? Is it service providers who are supporting people in farming? Thinking about when's the right time to run an event? Is it right now? Because I know that, you know, some people are just surviving at the moment. Yeah. They may not be up for attending an event. Is it in a couple of months' time? How's that going to fit within the seasonal pressures? What's the right time in terms of your target audience? And then who else in your community can be helping you run this event? What we've seen, I guess, is some of the most successful events is where individuals may have taken the initiative to start the event, but they're actually then partnering with some of the other community organisations and the local government, maybe even a local health service, to really get that event off the ground.
And Alison, I like the idea too of really thinking about the timing and longevity as well, because this is grief that communities and individuals and farmers are going through, and it can be lifelong. It can hit and attack you at any given moment or time, often when people think maybe it's over and you're okay and you're not. So it's also looking at the longevity of that social connection.
That's so true, Rochelle. And I also think, you know, that reflects on the need to have a range of support services available. So look over the farm gate events and those community grants are really important part of that. But we also do need to recognise that, you know, the recovery is a long-term issue, and we need to be thinking about what sort of supports do communities need over that longer term. So this is kind of one piece of that bigger puzzle, I think.
Just quickly, Alison, how can people apply or try to get more information for this particular program, which is called Look Over the Farm Gate program? How can people get involved? Yeah.
So all of the information is already up on the National Centre for Farmer Health website. If they just type into Google Look Over the Farm Gate, that will pop up. There are guidelines. There is a really terrific package of information called Tackling the Tough Topics, and that will help people think through how to plan an event. We know that people are very well-meaning often but may not have experience in running events, particularly with that mental health focus. So Tackling the Tough Topics will really help people think that planning through, and that's all there on our website. If they do want to have a chat to somebody, they can give us a call at the centre on 5551 8533, and we have designated staff to help support the administration of those grants and to help communities plan.
5551 8533, and you can jump onto the website as well. Alison, thank you. It's really important.
No worries. Thanks, Rochelle.
See ya. Alison Kennedy is the director of the National Centre for Farmer Health. So you can jump onto the website, look over the Farm Gate program, and it's all about social connection, ensuring the mental health of our farmers and our farming community. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.